Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we hear from one Milwaukee area woman who plans to run 30 marathons by her 30th birthday.
First, torrential rains throughout southern Wisconsin led to widespread flooding this week in Dane County. In areas such as Belleville, roads have been washed away. And in Madison, the water levels of Lake Mendota and Lake Monona are still rising, causing havoc along some of the city's busiest roads.
More rain is also forecast throughout the weekend, potentially making cleanup efforts more difficult in the coming weeks. Our next guest has spoken with local officials and the National Weather Service to get a sense of how the next few weeks could shape up for the area.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Meg, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Judith.
So from what you're hearing, what is the latest on the flooding situation in Dane County right now?
Well, water levels are very high in Lake Mendota. And as you know, Mendota and Monona are all kind of connected through the Tenney Dam that goes through the Yahar River. Now, earlier today, what they were doing is they were releasing water from Lake Mendota into the Yahara River, and that's just to kind of relieve the flooding. But that means that water is going further on downstream, and so they're having difficulties. And anybody driving around in Madison already knows this. With like all 18 of the 19 beaches on Lake Mendota are closed because of bacteria in the water, and the low-lying areas, which are a lot of the streets around there, they're having to be closed because of water. Now, what they're saying now, and this could really wreak havoc on people driving in Madison, is that East Washington Avenue, they're probably going to have to close some lanes, and they might even have to close it completely if the water levels continue to rise between Mendota and Monona.
And as a motorist in Madison, I can confirm that that would be a very bad situation. What we are also hearing is that there's a lot riding on the dam that's at Tenney Park, and there's been some concern among city officials that the dam could be compromised if water levels go up any further. Were that to happen, how bad of a situation would that be for Madison and the residential areas around there?
Yeah, that could be quite dire because that's all connected in there, and the Tenney Dam is kind of a fail-safe for that. So I know that's all very, very much interconnected. And meanwhile, as folks are dealing with, you know, cleaning up and trying to get their cars back or their cars totaled, and just dealing with the havoc of trying to drive around, folks are looking up into the sky, though, because more rain is expected tonight. Probably it's going to come to Madison overnight, probably in the early morning hours, and then it's going to likely rain off and on tomorrow. Now, what the Weather Service is saying is that it doesn't look like it's going to be a relatively fast-moving system. There's a low-pressure system that's moving in from the Upper Plains states just to the north of, like in central Wisconsin, so we'll be in the southern end, which means we'll get a lot of humid humid moisture in that air. But the problem is, though, is that we've already got a lot of water. So you just add a half inch or an inch more water, and that's going to create a lot more problems.
Right. I mean, some areas of Madison got, you know, 7 to 10 inches of rain. So another 0.5 inch, inch and a half of rain doesn't sound so bad. But on top of all the water that's already there, it sounds like there could be some pretty bad consequences. How are residents and businesses preparing for the possibility of more flooding?
Well, I know Monona and the city of Madison are filling up sandbags, and I know the city of Madison just recently brought in another 100,000 sandbags, and also the state's sandbag filling system. So people are kind of hunkering down. They're trying to save what property that they have that hasn't already been affected. I do know that the National Weather Service is saying what had happened on Monday night, which was really kind of unusual, is that the system just parked over western Dane County and didn't move. Normally, if you have that much rain, it moves through. It may be 30 miles an hour, 45 miles an hour, and it moves off. But it was just one of those strange confluences where it just stayed there. It was like basically western Dane County was just under like a big, huge shower spigot. This one is going to be moving off much quicker, but that still is going to mean that there's going to be rain falling. So, yeah, you've got already saturated ground. You've already got filled lakes and rivers. and those are only going to rise.
We're talking right now with Meg Jones. She's a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we are getting an update on the flooding situation here in southern Dane County. And Meg, moving out of Madison for a second, some of the hardest hit areas were a little bit to the south and west of Madison in the areas of Cross Plains, in Black Earth, in Mazo, and people ended up in shelters because of it. What are we hearing about how many people are still residing in shelters at the moment?
Well, I know there was no people that stayed overnight in the there's three shelters, one at Madison High School, one at the middle school in Cross Plains, and then the Mazo Mani Elementary School. Mazo Mani shelter was the only one that had people staying overnight, and that was a dozen people. But the rest of the shelters are also busy, though, because people can come in and get free cleanup kits. And a cleanup kit is like a bucket, sponges, bleach, mops, that type of thing. The Red Cross is providing that. But they're also coming in to get food and maybe a shower or something like that. But Mazo Mani, though, those folks got hit very hard. And I know Tuesday morning and much of through Tuesday, they were still doing water rescues in Mazo Mani to try and get people out of their homes. And I know a lot of those folks have found other shelter either with families or friends. But the Red Cross told me, though, that they plan to stay open. They weren't going to be closing up after today because of the rain coming in. So they're not sure whether more people are going to be needing those shelters, and they're going to be open for the remaining future.
We've also heard reports of highways being washed out, of travel being difficult getting in and out of these areas. What have you heard from emergency officials on how easy it is to get in and out of these towns and villages at this point?
Well, it's not. It's not easy to get in there because kind of the main artery that connects Black Earth, Cross Plains, and Mazo Mani is basically it's washed out. Because of Black Earth Creek, it was rising. And the thing about it, I talked to the DOT yesterday, and they've got crews out assessing just how bad everything is. But there were some areas that were still inaccessible to the DOT inspectors to try and find out how bad bridges and how bad roads are. So, you know, and that's not a quick fix. That's not like they can go in and put in a new road in a day or so. That's going to be quite some time. So I imagine that there's going to be a lot of detours through that area for many weeks until they can get in, until the waters go down, until they can get in and replace bridges and culverts and roads that have washed away.
Is it too early to put a price tag on the amount of damage that we're possibly looking at here?
From what I've heard, yes. I haven't heard any specific number yet, and of course, you know, you're dealing with a lot of different municipalities. Mazo Mani will have their own damage, and Cross Plains, and the city of Madison and Monona. What all I know is that Paul Soglin, Madison Mayor Paul Soglin, said on Tuesday that it's unknown at this point, but that it's in the millions of dollars, and it's not just people who lost their cars. It's people, whose businesses and homes were affected. And so plus you've got multiple jurisdictions. So I just think it's fair to say that it's millions of dollars, but I'm still waiting, and it'll probably take a few more days before we get a definitive estimate of damage.
Talk a little bit more about the state response to this. I know that Governor Walker has been out touring some of the damaged areas, declaring here in Dane County, County Executive Joe Parisi declaring a state of emergency. Talk about the response that we've seen so far from local and state policymakers.
Yeah, well, so it's a much lower bar to declare a state of emergency for like a city or for a county than it is to be considered a federal disaster area. So, and that takes a lot of paperwork and a lot of people, boots on the ground, kind of figuring out what's going on. So, whether that area will get federal disaster funds, you know, on akin to like hurricanes or you know that kind of stuff when FEMA gets through, I think that's going to take a while before we know about that. But on a local level, though, the city of Monona declared a state of emergency, and the county declared a state of emergency, and that frees up people. You know, they can call in National Guard troops. They can call in other units to help out with that sort of thing. And it also what also I know is that when I was talking to the Red Cross just recently, they said they're trying to open up one area, kind of a one-stop shop, someplace in western Dane County where everybody that's been affected can go, and basically they go to the one location, and I've seen this with other floods where emergency management is there, and the Salvation Army is there, and insurance companies are there, and so basically it's a one-stop place where people can go, listen, I lost my car and my basement was flooded, what do I do? Or, so they can all go to one spot and get help with filing for insurance and that sort of thing.
And as we wrap up, Meg, we've talked a lot about statistics and figures and dollar amounts, but throughout this whole week, there have been a lot of just human stories coming out of this. And I'm wondering, during the course of your reporting, what are some of these stories that may have stuck with you?
Well, I interviewed Milwaukee Alderman Matt Fair, who he and his wife Connie were just out for a bike ride around 9 p.m. on Monday, when they came upon Jim Sewell's SUV that was stuck in a culvert. And it was Matt Fair got very emotional, as you can probably imagine, describing what he saw and how he tried to save Jim Sewell, but because the waters were just so strong that he lost Jim Sewell. And I talked to Jim Sewell, the gentleman that was swept away from his car, I talked to somebody at the Wisconsin Historical Society today and learned that Jim Sewell was a very interesting man. He was the first historic preservation architect in the state of Wisconsin, and he worked at the State Historical Society for almost 25 years, and he was a renowned expert in historical architecture, and he did a lot of work with Taliesin and basically set up the whole program for historic preservation architecture here in the state of Wisconsin. So that's a big loss to our community.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Meg, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Meg Jones is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she joined us today to talk about the widespread flooding in Dane County and how local leaders are preparing for another big rainstorm this weekend.
There's something about those landmark birthdays that seem to get people thinking about life accomplishments and future goals. Maybe it's visiting all the state parks in Wisconsin by age 50 or visiting all the Great Lakes before age 30. Our next guest set her sights high and plans to finish 30 marathons. That's 26.2 miles each by the time she turns 30 early next year.
And we'd like to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Do you have any goals of accomplishing something before a milestone birthday, fitness-related or other? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
And actually, we heard from Rory in Madison. She says, I love traveling and had always wanted to visit all 50 states. I had made good progress on the goal and had visited 45 states as my 40th birthday was approaching. I wanted to do something memorable for the milestone birthday and decided that getting to 50 states by my 40th birthday was well within reach. Thanks to help and company from family and friends, I visited three more states in the months leading up to my birthday and spent the last two weekends before my birthday flying to Texas and Idaho. I managed to get my 50th state checked off with 5 days to spare. Well, I'm sure our next guest, Tori Hartman, can appreciate that accomplishment. Tori is a fitness blogger and personal trainer in Brookfield, Wisconsin. She's completed 26 of the 30 marathons she will run by her 30th birthday. Tori, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So 30 marathons, that's a lot of running. But what I found so interesting is you actually haven't been a serious runner for all that long. Tell us a little bit about why you started running.
Well, I really started to run because I was in college and I was getting really frustrated from the stress of being in college. And I just decided running was a good way to blow off some of the stress. And I went out for like a little jog. And I was kind of let one of my professors get into my head, and I was like, you know, he might be right that, like, this might not be a good fit for me being in school, but I know I can run. So I just put one foot in front of the other and came home and decided to sign up for a marathon.
So your first goal that you set was running your first marathon. What was that like? That's a big goal. That's certainly intimidating to me. What was it like as you kind of geared yourself up mentally and physically for that?
Well, I actually, when I started my first marathon, I wasn't at all physically prepared, but I guess I was definitely mentally prepared. I didn't have a GPS watch, and smartphones weren't as popular as they are today. So I actually was using my car speedometer and, like, driving to parks and kind of using that as my gauge of distance. And what I thought was, like, my 13-mile run actually was, like, 6.
Oh, no.
And, like, my 5K course, actually, I ran that this morning, is a little less than 2 miles. So it's like, you know, I was here in my head, I was like, yeah, I'm really physically prepared for this. And then I have an aunt who is really into running, and she's actually, like, a multiple-time Boston qualifier and Boston marathon runner. So I didn't reach out for help from her, but I really wish I would have, because if I would have just gotten some key advice, I don't think I would have made some mistakes that I made the first marathon that I ran.
So I think, you know, talking about setting goals and setting a deadline, I do think milestone birthdays are kind of convenient that way. If you're looking for a deadline to set for yourself, those big round numbers are kind of handy. And so you wish you had reached out and talked to your aunt who knew a lot and probably could have saved you some physical pain and some emotional grief. But, you know, what role do other people play, do you think, in setting those goals and helping us reach them?
I think other people are critical to setting goals and reaching your goals. I mean, I would not be where I am today without such a great support that I have from all my family and friends. I mean, they would constantly ask me about it almost in like a joking way. But it really helped push me along towards getting to the goal.
And it's kind of accountability. I mean, once you put it out there publicly, you're kind of stuck, right? In a good way.
Exactly.
We're talking right now with Tori Hartman. She's a fitness blogger and personal trainer in Brookfield, Wisconsin. She plans to run her 30th marathon on her 30th birthday in March of next year, and she writes about her fitness experiences on her blog, FitHart, and that's HART.com. And let's talk a little bit about, you know, you finished that first marathon, which I'm sure even though it sounds like maybe you weren't as prepared as you would have liked to have been, it has to be a huge high. What takes you from finishing that first one to, you know, maybe I'll run 30 of them?
Yeah. So I, like you said, it was a huge high. So I went home that night, and after maybe having a post-race celebration beer, I decided to sign up for a second half marathon. And from there, it just kind of was the snowball effect. So it just kept, I would like finish one and sign up for one, finish one and sign up for one. And then I kind of jokingly had thrown out the 30 before I was 30. And then one of my friends sat down with me and was like, I think you could actually do this. If you ran about 5 marathons a year, you could get to 30 marathons before you were 30. So then I just kind of played around with my budget and what I could really plan for going to races. And I've done a lot of local Wisconsin races, which I think was really awesome because it allowed me to experience different parts of the state that I have never been to.
And, you know, I think part of what you just said is really important, the planning, the putting it out on the calendar and saying, like, is this a reasonable goal? I mean, can I actually physically or financially do X by my 20th, 30th, 40th, 80th birthday? I turned 50 a couple years ago, and good friends decided, my birthday's in December, they decided the January before that it was going to be the year of Judith. And what that meant was that the four of us would do something together each month that none of us had ever done before. And I'm not talking about like bungee jumping and stuff. I'm talking about like going to a particular festival or trying something new. And it was really fun. And a lot of what was fun about it was, you know, having that kind of on the calendar and just knowing, oh, it's a new month. What are we going to do this month?
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
I kind of want every year to be the year of Judith.
Yeah, I do too. That sounds like a great year.
Well, so you've done, I think it's 26 marathons so far, but also a lot of half marathons, an ultra marathon. Does it ever get easier?
No, it never gets easier. Every time I go out, I try and make a new challenge for myself. Mentally or physically before I go out, and that kind of helps entertain me all the way through. But it never gets easier.
But okay, so like what? Like you're gonna, you know, run with one shoe, or I mean, like what kind of challenges are you doing?
So I'll make a challenge. Like I'll pick a color of shirt, and I'll be like, okay, I'm gonna try and beat all the orange shirts that I see.
Oh, that's
cool.
I'll
be like in the race, and I'll be like, all right, I want to beat the orange shirts. Or sometimes I like to run a lot of my races with family or friends, just because we can have some really great conversations. And one other times are you going to have 3 hours with this person? Probably not very often. You're distracted, of course, because you're running. But, you know, for the most part, you don't have your kids around or spouses or anything like that. So it's a really cool way to kind of get to know your friends a little bit better.
We're running short on time, but I want to make sure we get this in there. You told our producer, Natalie, that, you know, you, even though you've run all these marathons, you are not the fastest runner. It's still hard. Give us a pep talk on why we should tackle something and set a goal for ourselves that maybe really feels like a stretch for us.
Yep. So you should exactly set a goal for me that feels like a stretch, because it really is important to you, and I think it helps you as a person wake up every day and just be excited about something, and that you really just can go and experience life in a way that you weren't used to experiencing life before.
And it's okay if we're slow.
Yep, and it's okay if you're slow.
Well, Tori, thank you so much for joining us. It's a really great story, and now I'm going to set my next goal for some birthday.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Judith. I hope you have a great day.
You too. Tori Hartman is a fitness blogger and personal trainer in Brookfield, Wisconsin. She plans to run her 30th marathon on her 30th birthday in March of next year. And if you want to read more about her race experiences, race recommendations, and tips for new marathon runners, visit her website at fithart.com. Americans are having fewer babies. Since the 2008 recession, the fertility rate in the United States declined and has continued to drop, even though the economy has rebounded over the last decade.
The New York Times recently surveyed young people to find out why they were waiting to have children or foregoing parenthood entirely. Their answers ranged from personal reasons to economic concerns.
Our next guest is here to talk about what changing attitudes towards parenthood and kids means for families and society, and what policies could be enacted to help parents and children.
Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So let's start with what might be an obvious question, but I want to get your take on this. Why might this be concerning that Americans are having fewer children?
Well, of course, we are a society that tends to be based upon a continuous expansion of consumption. And I think in the long run, that's probably not going to work for us either environmentally or demographically. But that's one of the concerns. A more reasonable concern is that we do need people to pay into Social Security for the future. Children are very important resources, and we should make it easier for people to have them who want to have them. This year, the gap between the number of children women say they want to have and the number that they say they expect to have reached its widest point in 40 years. So even though there are some reasons for a slowdown in fertility that I don't think we will turn around, clearly there's lots of room to improve this because people would like to have more kids than they feel able to have.
The New York Times really wanted to put a spotlight on this, so they surveyed 1,800 men and women between the ages of 20 and 45 to find out why they were having fewer children, and in some cases, no children at all. There were a number of reasons. Some were personal choices, but a lot were due to economics and finances. Talk, if you could, Stephanie, about how the cost of raising a child has gone up over the years.
Yes, well, when people think about the high fertility rates of the past, they forget that for a long time, for thousands of years, children were the most important economic resource for the parents. They were what the parents invested in order to have child labor to get to take care of them in their old age. As the child labor has been abolished and as it's become more expensive to educate, as education has become more necessary, children have become more expensive. And one of the things that Americans in particular are concerned about are the childcare is much too expensive. And in fact, the That's way outstripped the cost of inflation, as has the price of sending kids to college, which, of course, most of us realize is a pretty important investment if your kids are going to do well at all. There's also, they're worried about the economy, they're all, and financial instability. And another big personal reason, but not a selfish personal reason, is that they want more time for the children they have. We've also raised our expectations of how much time people should spend with their children. People don't, a lot of people don't realize this, but today, working mothers spend more time interacting with their children than stay-at-home mothers did back in the 1950s and 60s.
We heard from Kelsey on Facebook, and she has one child, and she wrote, "We may have another child, but we may not. This country doesn't have family-friendly policies established to encourage the growth of healthy family units, so to afford the hospital bills, daycare tuition, and time off from work to heal and bond with a newborn is no simple feat. That, coupled with student loan debt, which truly seems to be my generation's largest barrier to financial stability, makes having children a difficult decision." Stephanie, is society just working against people at this point? In all aspects, who are looking to have children?
Yes, I think that this is a major problem. And the few places that where we've seen upticks in fertility are in places that have made it much easier for women and men both to combine work and family. We find that fertility rates have ticked up where there is quality childcare that is affordable or universal, as it is in places like France, and when there are good family leave policies. And by the way, it's really important that those aren't just for women anymore, because one of the big changing new values in relationships between men and women is that women want access to the work world as well as access to family time for raising their children, and they want men to be more involved, and men want to be more involved. So we found that with their studies in Europe that show that there is a real strong predictor that when you have paternal leave as well as maternal leave and men get involved at an early age, women are much more likely to have a second or third child than in places where they are continue to be primarily responsible for the child raising.
There's been a lot of talk in politics these days about paid family leave, trying to get that off the ground. But I'm wondering where something like that needs to start, in your opinion. Does that start on the federal level? Does it start on the state level? Or does it start somewhere else?
Well, I think we have to work on many, many different levels for it. Obviously, the federal government has not been as responsive to it as most Americans, whatever their political ideology, would like. And so you're getting these individual initiatives at the city level or the state level. But, of course, the problem with leaving it there is that you can then have a situation where the worst states and the worst corporations become the most competitive because there's a race to the bottom. Unless you have some sort of floor set, it's really not fair to the corporations and the states that want to do right.
One other thing I'm wondering about while we're talking about economic reasons, before we move on to the personal reasons, it seems like throughout history, the traditional progression has been you get married, you buy a house, and then you have kids. And I'm wondering now, we're hearing across the country, housing costs are out of control. People are having a hard time buying a house because houses are either too expensive in their area or they can't do it because they have college debt, they have other expenses. And I'm wondering if that step doesn't happen, the buying a house, having the living arrangement straightened out, does that also have an impact on whether or not people are going to have kids?
Well, I think housing costs have something to do with it. And I think perhaps even more important, though, is student debt and the extent to which people have confidence that the country is moving forward, that there's some job stability and security in their future. You know, you look back to the big baby boom after World War II, and it was a very different situation, some in good ways, some in bad ways. In good ways, it was a period where every young generation of men aged 25 to 35 was earning three times as much as their fathers had earned at the same age, and when you put it in constant dollars. Housing prices, as you say, were really low. A 30-year-old man could buy a median-priced home on 18% of his yearly income. So the result was that young men could afford to have children. They could afford to have a family. The bad part of it is that young women didn't have much choice other than to get married and have babies, because there were help wanted male odds and the help wanted female ads were not for jobs that paid a living wage, and they were temporary jobs. And so there was just no way that women had any possibility of having another kind of life outside the home in addition to the home. So now, of course, we've got a very different situation. It's much harder for young men to get started and support a family. You really need two incomes. And women not only feel that they need two incomes, but they also expect to be at work and enjoy being at work. Women who work continuously are much healthier mentally and physically at age 40 than women who stay home that most of the time. So the result is that we need a much better arrangement. We have to give up the idea that you can organize your work life, your school hours, and your family policies on the assumption that there'll be one set of workers, male, who are totally available to the employer and can work long hours and be available whenever they're wanted. And there's another set of people, primarily female, who will stay home and take care of the rest of life. That's just not the way it works anymore. And we're not going to have any rise in fertility, substantial rise in fertility, until we recognize that. You know, it used to be when you made it hard for women to work that they stayed home and had babies. Today, in today's environment, when you make it hard for women to combine work and family, they often don't have babies at all.
We are talking with Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and she's also the director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families. We're talking about why Americans are having fewer babies. And I want to go to a call now, and we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us now in La Crosse. Hi, Ben.
Hi. I just want to comment on the premise here. I understand that on a local level, the issue of the demographics of fewer children in the society creates problems. And the issues brought up about Social Security and supporting the elderly in the society are issues that have been discussed and debated. But beyond that, on a macro level, we have to keep in mind that there are over 7 billion people on the planet, and that's created a whole host of severe problems that may threaten the species itself. Wars, environmental damage, overpopulation is a serious, serious issue, and the decline in birth rates in some quarters is considered a blessing.
And Ben, thank you so much for that call. Stephanie, some respondents to the New York Times sort of echoed what Ben was saying. Some listed concerns over global instability, domestic politics, climate change was another one, and overpopulation. Do you get the sense that people are thinking more about these issues when considering starting a family at this point?
Well, I certainly hear a lot of my former students and young people when I go around the country giving lectures on the changing family life talk about the concerns, for example, about climate change. And, you know, you would think you have a refugee problem now. You wait till the seas are rising, and they're very concerned about that, and they talk about that. I think that your caller raises a good point, and it's really something that, as a society, we have based our whole economic system on the idea that you have to have the market, consumer market, expand continuously. So you've got to have more kids, more people to buy. We've got to rethink that at this point in the history of our planet, as well as in our immediate demographic trends.
We are talking with Stephanie Kuntz right now. She is Director of Research at the Council on Contemporary Families, and we're talking about why Americans are having fewer babies.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a young person who's waiting to have kids or have decided not to? What influenced your choice? Have you gotten pushback from friends and relatives? And what would you like to see change in order to support families? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a moment after the short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about why Americans are having fewer children. Our guest is Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and is the director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What challenges do you think people face when they decide to have children or not? Are you in the process of making that decision now? If you have children already, what do you wish you'd considered before having kids? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
And Stephanie, before we go to the phones, I want to ask, I'm wondering if we've made significant public health progress in decades, things like reducing the amount of unintended pregnancies, of teen pregnancies. Does that kind of factor in here as to why we're seeing such a low fertility rates?
Well, yes, it does. And because, of course, one of the things that is a kind of good news but challenge at the same time is that women are having children at a much older age. The average age of first-time mothers is 26, up from 21 back in the 1970s. And educated women with college degrees have children an average of 7 years later than those without. And that's very good news for their children economically, educationally. They turn out, you know, these children get more time, they have more resources. But it also means that women are much closer to hitting their biological limits, and they may not be able to have as many children as they want. So this is a difficult balancing act for women to decide, you know. There is tremendous advantage economically and emotionally and in your relationship with your significant other in delaying having children. But on the other hand, you do run into the declining fertility, especially by the time you're 39 or 40. So those are something to take into account. Can I just add one other interesting thing?
Absolutely.
About America? One of the things, when you think about the personal reasons that people say, America has the largest deficit in happiness between parents and non-parents of all of the industrial countries in the OECD that were recently studied by Jennifer Glass and her colleagues, that parents just find it much more difficult because of this lack of family support systems. And in many countries, parents are equally happy or even more happy than non-parents, but not here. And so that's another point to bear in mind.
Yeah, that echoes something that Sadie wrote on Facebook, who wrote about having children. I just don't feel the need. Both our parents really want us to have a child, and I am just not there. I'm 32. I know they are just so much work, and right now I'm just not interested in doing that work. I enjoy my life as it is, and we need to experience more adventure and more self-fulfillment, and kids take up all your time. And Stephanie, is that something that you're hearing a lot, comments like that from Sadie?
Well, I don't hear it as much as you might think. I mean, when the New York Times went through it, that sort of "I want more leisure time for myself" was kind of low on the list, actually. But it's certainly more common here than in countries that have good work-family policies that allow people. I mean, here in America, it's so hard to get vacation time. We don't have the guaranteed vacation time. We certainly don't have the guaranteed maternity leave and paternity leave that's necessary for women and men to really share these kinds of things. And one of the interesting things is new research that's being done on what makes for satisfying marriages is that actually the happiest couples are the ones that really share childcare and breadwinning equally. But it's very difficult to do that in our current system. So it may be that these couples find that if they don't have the childcare to worry about, that they can do the kinds of leisure activities that in fact increase their happiness and their satisfaction. So I think that this is not an inevitable problem with having children, but it's a particularly strong problem in the United States.
We are talking with Stephanie Kuntz. She's the Director of Research at the Council on Contemporary Families. And now to your calls at 800-642-1234. And we'll go to Lynn in Madison. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just have a couple quick comments. I think also part of the reason women don't want to are not choosing not to have kids is, I kind of knew for my teen years that I'm pretty sure I wasn't going to have them. People told me I would change my mind, and you have them so you have somebody to take care of you when you're older, and I didn't find that very convincing. And so I'm middle-aged now, probably beyond the point. But I think that the decline started when the New Deal started, deregulation started happening in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And productivity and wages don't keep up. And then you factor in the fact that female-dominated fields, even if they support high-paying people like doctors versus medical technologists who are laboratory technicians, female-dominated, they don't get paid anywhere near. I mean, I started out at $12.89 an hour post my graduation from the university.
And Lynn, thank you so much for that call. Stephanie, can you respond to what Lynn had to say there?
Well, yes, there's a couple of things. First of all, it's absolutely true that the gender pay gap is really a problem for women, and it gets much worse after parenthood. In fact, parenthood is now the major contributor to the gender pay gap. If you postpone your childbearing until your late 30s, it's far less of a problem, but it also means that you're less likely to have more than one kid, even if you want more than one or two kids. So that's one factor to it. I think it's really important to get past the idea that it's selfish not to have kids. I mean, I'm a mom, and I'm really, it was just the light of my life. On the other hand, I spent less time taking care of my Alzheimer's mother than my single childless sister did, because single childless people also play a very important role in caregiving and reaching out to other people. So I think we have to get away from the idea that it's selfish not to have kids.
Thank you so much, Lynn, for the call. We'll go next to Pleasant Prairie now, and we'll talk to Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if we fit in so much. My wife actually wanted to be a stay-at-home wife. We had our first daughter 3 years ago, and our hardest decision was, do we have the second? And this was based on my salary. I was making, well, still am, about $60,000 a year. And health insurance, the cheapest option through work, is $12,000 a year. So 20% of my income is going straight to health insurance. So now, do we add a second kid? And the benefits we get from her staying home and taking care of our child, our first child, do we lose that now because she has to go to work just to pay for, life?
And Matthew, thank you so much for the call. We are running low on time, but Stephanie, I'm wondering if you could address, these conversations that couples must have, wanting to have another child and just feeling like they can't, must be devastating. Is this something that you're hearing a lot from couples?
Well, it is. It's very hard. I mean, there are couples that want to have the stay-at-home person, and those are very disadvantaged couples. Any single earner couple in today's world is disadvantaged compared to two earner couples. And of course, now we have, with the health care, the fact that we don't have universal health care and it's tied to people's work status, that makes it even more difficult for many people who want to have kids. So these are all very important factors that we need to discuss, I think, in a way that is sympathetic to our needs as a society and to people's individual choices.
And lots more to talk about, but unfortunately we are out of time. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families, and she joined us today to talk about some of the reasons why Americans are having fewer babies. And we do have a conversation going on over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you didn't get a chance to get on today, or you still want to share your story about why you're putting off having kids, why you didn't have kids, plenty of time to share your story. Just head on over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, share your story. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR or email us ideas@WPR.org.
We saw an article the other day that talked about a board game kiosk that's parked outside of a Milwaukee office building for a month or so, and we loved that idea.
Yeah, and then we got kind of jealous because it turns out that is stationed right outside the building where WPR's Milwaukee studios are located.
Well, the kiosk has a couple dozen free tabletop games. Think Yahtzee, Jenga, Sorry, Clue, Battleship. It's sponsored by the Downtown Milwaukee Business Improvement District. And I don't know, Chris, if it was parked outside our offices, do you think you'd go down there?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I love love board games. I would definitely go down there. My fear when I first heard about this is, like, I'm envisioning someone playing, like, a very competitive game of Monopoly and then a strong breeze coming by and just blowing all the paper money everywhere. But maybe they're focusing on games that have, like, heavier pieces on the board.
Yeah, we do have kind of a wind tunnel outside of our building. Well, we've had other fun things outside of Vilas Hall here in Madison. In exam week in May, I looked out the window and there were puppies down there because they had brought them in for, like, stress reduction for students. And I have to admit, I couldn't get down from the 7th floor to go pet them. But even just seeing them from above made me kind of happy.
And in just a couple of weeks, the students come back. We are on a university campus. That means there is free food down there. So that's what I'm going to be looking forward to.
UW cops often bring free coffee.
Coffee. And I've seen some pastries. I've seen pizza down there. You're the one with the window looking over there, Judith. So you're going to have to keep me updated on what
will.
You see.
Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll talk about the benefits of spending our vacation time at home. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.